I've been particularly struck this week by the pairing of Isaiah and Simon in these texts and their claim, woe is me, go away from me, I'm a sinner. That sense of being unworthy in the presence of the holy. So I want to reflect on that, but I want to do it in the context of the psalm. And particularly verse 7, I think, of that psalm. I don't know if it's in there. Although on high, God cares for the lowly and perceives the haughty from afar. As I was discussing that psalm this week with the Wednesday gathering group, that word haughty caught me. God cares for the lowly and perceives the haughty from afar. What does it mean to be haughty? What is haughty? Anybody know? Do we have a linguist in the room? I think it's about pride, right? There are theologians who've said, well, the greatest of all the sins, if you're going to sin, is the sin of pride, which got me thinking about that. What does it mean to be haughty versus humble? And maybe I started with humble. When I was in AA, the awful talk about being humble, but the definition of humble in AA is being right-sized. It's not thinking about yourself lower than you ought, but it's not thinking about yourself higher than you ought, right? So it's not groveling in how unworthy and how depraved and awful you are, which, you know, misses out on the good that is actually there, right? But it's also not thinking, you know, it's being right-sized, and that seemed to be a very helpful definition for humility, to be right-sized, to be honest and authentic and real about who you are and your need for help, your need for grace, what your strengths are, but what your weaknesses are. That felt very helpful. So whatever haughty is, it's not that. Right? Haughty is, and I think when I think about pride, it's actually self-sufficiency. It's a profound trust in one's own greatness, in one's own capacity, that you don't need others. You are all that you need. Like there's a self-sufficiency to it. You don't even need God, which is why it's pride. If you don't need God, you're putting yourself above God. That's what pride is. That's what it means to be haughty. And so it's curious in the psalm that says, although God is on high, God cares for the lowly and perceives the haughty from afar. I don't hear God judging the haughty there. I don't hear God condemning them because of their pride. But there's a distance. God sees them, but they're distant from the divine. They're distant from the lover of their souls. They're distant from their creator. And they keep themselves distant in their self-sufficiency. We live in a world, I think, right now, there's a lot of folks who are full of pride, right? A lot of folks who are full of their own power and their own greatness, their own sense that they don't need God. They are gods unto themselves. And we live in a world where we need people who are humble, who are right-sized. I'm struck by how these two texts about Simon and Isaiah speak to that. In the Isaiah text, it's a very famous passage out of Isaiah, and it's Isaiah's call to be a prophet. The king Uzziah had died. King Uzziah started out as a good king, but then, you know, as time went along and he had power, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's why we need checks and balances. And so he'd end up being a bad king. And so Isaiah hears this call. And what he has is a vision of being in the Holy of Holies. That's what this vision is. It's the throne room of God. It's the Holy of Holies in the temple. And all he can, all he hears is this song that's going on, right? And he sees these flaming creatures, these flaming angels of this seraphim flying around. And he sees the hem of God's robe. So he doesn't actually see God. All he sees is the bottom hem of God's robe. That's all he can see. And he hears this song that the seraphs are singing. The seraphs are sitting there flying. They've got two wings in the back. They've got two wings that are covering their faces. And they've got two wings that are covering their feet, which is a euphemism for your private parts. That's what they're doing. And they're flying around, singing, "Holy, holy, holy." And I try to imagine the sound of what that might have sounded like. I imagine it was haunting. I imagine it was majestic. I imagine it was stirring. And yet somehow just, you know, when you get caught up into the music, I imagine this is what Isaiah is feeling, this holy, 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 this sense of something so great and so beyond his own capacity to comprehend and or survive. And Isaiah's response in being in the presence of the divine, of being in the presence of the sacred mystery, is to say, "Woe is me, I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips." He's full of fear, but he has a sense, a profound sense of his own inadequacy, of his own unworthiness, of his own sinfulness even. He doesn't belong. He doesn't feel like he belongs in the presence of the divine. And as he says that, one of the seraphs takes, there's an altar there with fire and coals in there. And one of the seraphs takes one of these coals in a tong and brings it and sears Isaiah's lips. Except his lips are not destroyed, they're purified, right? And his mouth is open. These unclean lips have been now made holy, and his guilt has been released. And God says, he hears the voice of God saying, "Whom shall I send?" And in our translation, Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me," and there's an exclamation point right after it. And so you too should be excited about following God. And that's where usually the gospel text ends, right? "Here am I, send me." And maybe that was his response. In my experience, though, that's not usually how it goes. Most of us aren't that excited about following God for whatever reason, right? And so, you know, I imagine Isaiah hearing that the God say, "Whom should I send?" And Isaiah looks around, and there's nobody else in the room, right? I mean, like, he doesn't have a lot of options. And he's like, "Well, here I am. You can send me." That feels truer somehow. At least it was true in my case. I don't want to project that onto you, but own it if you feel like it's relevant. And usually, again, that's where, when we read this text in church, we cut it off because we don't want to read the other verses, because we're afraid to deal with the other verses. So let's read the other verses. Because the message that God gives to Isaiah is hard. It's hard to understand. Isaiah is commissioned to go to God's people, and to God's people, Isaiah is saying, "Keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand." And already you're like, what? "Make the mind of this people dull and stop their ears and shut their eyes so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears and comprehend with their minds and turn and be healed." And you're like, what? Doesn't God want our healing? What does this have to do with love? If God is the God of love, this is why people talk about the Old Testament God. They're like, "Oh, no, that's that Old Testament God. I don't want to have anything to do with that Old Testament God." I think it's because we read this as if it's being prescriptive, as if this is what God is, as if he's cursing the people somehow. And I wonder, is it really prescriptive or is it descriptive? Because this is what the people of God have been like. They've been listening, but they don't hear. They keep looking and they don't understand. They don't comprehend. They don't understand. They see, but they have eyes that do not see. They have ears, but they have ears that do not hear. And that's been the experience of God with God's people for a long time, that God's desire has always been to heal them and to express healing. And God keeps calling them, and they're like, yeah, no, thank you. I've got some other gods that I've been paying attention to. I've got other things I want to give my obedience and allegiance to. I've got other things that actually I want to give power to, not you so much. And that's the story of God's people in the Old Testament, actually. That is basically what it's all about. It's God always saying, hey, I love you. I want to be your God, and I want you to be my people. And it's God's people always saying, yeah, okay. And so when it says, I think God is giving a description here, because this feels true often to the human condition. This feels true to often what humans do. We listen and we see, we think we see, we listen and we look, but we don't comprehend and we don't understand. That feels descriptive of so much of our world. And I think that last phrase, don't make their minds dull, stop their ears, shut their eyes, so that they may not turn and be healed. I mean, God's been offering healing all along, and this seems to the point where he's like, okay, no more healing. And it feels like reverse psychology, quite honestly, because they didn't want the healing before, so maybe God's like, okay, I'm not going to give it to you. And then all of a sudden people are like, oh, really? Well, now I want it. I suggest that might be happening. And Isaiah says, how long? And Isaiah is troubled by this message because his heart is for the people. He doesn't want to see the people suffer. And then I said, how long, O Lord? And God says, until cities lie waste without inhabitant and houses without people and the land is utterly desolate, until the Lord sends everyone far away and vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land. This is what happened to the people of Israel. There were wars and there was destruction, and the Assyrian army came in and destroyed the northern kingdoms of Israel. And their cities were laid waste and their houses were empty. But then you've got this image of a stump that gets burned and burned again. You know, this image of an oak or a terebinth tree or a cedar. You could use a cedar, but when a tree gets cut and destroyed and burned and you think it's dead, the last line there is the message of hope. The holy seed is its stump, that stump is seed and there is life, and that it's still possible that a branch can grow out of that stump and that the tree can grow again. What I like about these texts is that they're really wrestling with what happens when things are destroyed, what happens when our world falls apart, what happens when what we've loved is no longer there. And how is it that God can be in the midst of that? And is there hope? The Luke text has a similar kind of story where somebody is wrestling with their own unworthiness. Jesus is teaching. He's teaching on the lake shore, and the crowds are gathering, and it's hard for them to hear. So Jesus, in his acoustic brilliance, notices these boats, and he's like, okay, if I go out onto the water a little ways, and I can preach from the boat, then the water will help amplify my voice and carry my voice to the crowds that are standing there on the seashore. So that's what Jesus is doing here. He's commandeered this boat. Simon and his brother Andrew and James and John, the sons of Zebedee, have been fishing all night long, and they didn't catch anything. And they're probably discouraged, and they're probably weary, and they're ready to go home and take a nap. But Jesus commandeers his boat, so Peter sits there and Simon sits there and listens to a sermon. And then when Jesus is done, Jesus is like, let's go fish it. Let's go out into the deep water and let's put down some nets. Which is not sound like a good idea to Simon at that point. And his response is, look, we've worked all night long and we caught nothing. And this is not the time to catch fish. This isn't a good idea. So it's curious. Like, he doesn't think it's a good idea. He's not really into it. But he says, yet if you say so, I'll let down the nets. So even in the midst of doubting, even in the midst of being crabby and not thinking it's a good idea and whatever, he's still willing. I think that's what's key here. He's willing. So they go. They do this. And as they do this, all of a sudden, for no reason, all of a sudden these nets are so full of fish that he has to call James and John to come and help them get the fish into the boats, and they're unloading all this fish. And this man who spent his life fishing has never seen so many fish, right? And he has this moment of the inbreaking of the holiness of God. That's why he's terrified. That's why he's afraid, is because somehow in the abundance of all this fish, this is what the holiness of God looks like. Abundance of fish. When you least expect it. And what's curious is his response. He's like, he kneels at Jesus' knees. I mean, he gets down at, Jesus is sitting there, and he gets down on his own knees. And he says, go away from me. Get away from me. I am a sinful man. I don't know what, I mean, it's that moment. I don't think he's full of self-contempt. I don't feel that this is a man who has problems with low self-esteem. Right? And so this isn't about that. I think this is a man who has probably kind of lived his life and, you know, kind of been pretty ordinary and, you know, but he has this moment in the presence of the holy that shakes him to his core, and he feels unworthy. And Jesus' response to him is, don't be afraid, because I think you're worthy. I think you've got what it takes. I think you're just the right person. You're sufficiently right-sized to do this thing. And so the story goes, they get ashore, and Peter and Andrew and James and John leave everything, all that fish, more fish than they've ever caught in their life. They're about to make a bunch of money, and they leave it sitting there for someone else to gather, and they follow him. What do we do with that? As the people of God, what do we do with that? What do I do with that? I'm struck by the tendency is, I can be both haughty. I have the capacity to be haughty. I have the capacity to be proud. I have the capacity to think of, to be self-sufficient, to be full of myself and not have space for God or not have space for something greater than myself. I have that capacity. And I'm called to be honest, right? I'm called to be authentic. I'm called to be real about who I am, what my strengths are, but what my failings are. Because if we're not honest, if we don't have the capacity to be honest about our failings and our inadequacies and our sins, we won't be open to grace. And we won't be open to mercy. There's a real need for mercy in our world right now. There's a real need for having compassion for others. I hear that people are talking about the sin of empathy. Like, one response to Bishop Buddy's sermon was that people were accusing her of the sin of empathy. And I'm like, the sin of empathy? That's twisted. Because if you don't believe in empathy, you don't believe in mercy. And if you don't believe in mercy, you don't believe in grace. And if you don't believe in grace and mercy, you're not a Christian. So don't posture yourself as being a Christian and calling it the sin of empathy when you're totally perverting what the story is all about. We're called to mercy, and we're called to grace. Amen.